You guys, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books was nominated for a Webby Award, which is this really prestigious award that I am dying to win. And there's a People's Voice component, and you can vote and get me from number two, second place, to first place. But you have to vote. Please go to vote.webbys.com. Vote.webbys.com, but it's kind of complicated, so it might be easier just to go to zibbyowens.com or my Instagram at zibbyowens, where it'll always be in my stories and it's in one of those little circle highlights. Please, please, please vote. Voting ends April 18th and I'm in second place, so please vote for best individual episode, talk show, interview show. Thank you so much.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLaughlin. Jay McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLaughlin's local and loyal programming, host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern, and the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLaughlin, and so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white open long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLaughlin. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you like this podcast, you will love my new anthology called Moms Don't Have Time to Have Kids. Check it out, and you'll hear from 49 authors about all sorts of things moms don't have time to do. All the authors have been on this podcast. Also, check out my TikTok, at With Zibby and Tracy, my other podcast, Sex Talk with Zibby and Tracy. Check out Moms Don't Have Time to Write on Medium. And of course, my new publishing company called Zibby Books. And now back to our daily author interview site and a quick hello from some of my kids.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Enjoy the show.
Happy New Year, everyone. I hope you all had a great break. I wanted to let you know about something that I've been talking a lot about on social media at Zibby Owens, which is the hashtag 22in22 challenge. We are at Zibby Books. We are encouraging everybody, like all of you, to visit 22 bookstores in 2022. And we're going to provide a whole series of incentives for every 5 visits, and you'll be entered to win a $500 shopping spree, and you'll get fun things like bookmarks and all the rest. Plus, you'll be part of a great community of people all helping support
bookstores, authors, and more. We're really, really excited about it. If you want to join, sign up. You just go to 22in22.net. That's 22in22.net and click I'm in and put your information. And then every time you go to a bookstore, you just quickly go back on the site and click log a bookstore visit. And then we'll be keeping track and we'll be following up with all of your different achievements and awards and everything. So please sign up, spread the word. 22 and 22, get your friends to join and start visiting bookstores, and it'll be really fun and exciting. So here's to a wonderful 2022. I'm so excited that you're listening to my podcast and doing all the fun things that I have been trying to bring into the world. So here we go, 2022. Hashtag 22 and 22. Francine Prose is the author of The Vixen, a novel. Francine is the author of 21 works of fiction, including the highly acclaimed Mr. Monkey, the New York Times bestseller, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, Changed Man, which won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Her works of nonfiction include the highly praised Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and the New York Times bestseller Reading Like a Writer, which has become a classic. The recipient of numerous grants and honors, including a Guggenheim and a Fulbright, a Director's Fellow at the Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library, Prose is a former president of Penn America Center and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She is a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. And this was part of my series at the Temple Emanuel Stryker Center, Women on the Move. Hi, Francine.
Thank you so much. I'm fine. Thank you both.
Of course. Well, Francine, congratulations on The Vixen, your latest novel. You have been such a prolific author, as Marjorie said, and have done so much writing about reading and writing yourself, which I also would love to talk to you about today. But I was hoping we could start, for those who are here today but haven't read The Vixen yet, if you could talk a little bit about that. And honestly, it read so much like a memoir. I kept having to flip back. I was like, is she the one who was sitting there with her parents watching the TV? I was like, did I get it wrong? Except obviously there are some significant differences. So
yeah, I was the one sitting there with my parents watching the TV, but my main character is a man. So
I realize I'm not the one.
Yes. The novel takes place, that first scene takes place in 1953, in June 1953. And my hero, Simon Putnam, just graduated from Harvard, is back, having failed to figure out a plan for his future. He's back with his parents in Coney Island, and they're watching the news reports of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, which takes place on that night of June 19th. And it's a strange scene because they're watching the reports on TV, and at the same time, all these 50s TV series are interrupting, like I Love Lucy and the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson Show and so forth. And it's complicated because Simon's mother was a high school friend of Ethel Rosenberg. So the event has a kind of personal resonance for the family in addition to its historical resonance. And then we fast forward about 6 months to September, and Simon has gotten a job through the hard work of his mother and the offices of his uncle, who's this kind of sadistic public intellectual, at a very old-fashioned, waspy publishing firm. And his first job is to read the slush pile of just unsolicited submissions that have come in. And they were sort of fun to write, you know, just just titles for novels that would never be published by anyone, everywhere. And his first assignment, his first real assignment, is to edit a novel, a first novel. And he's horrified, truly horrified, to find out that it's this sleazy, lurid bodice ripper very loosely based on the Rosenberg case, that there's a character. The novel is called The Vixen, The Patriot, and The Fanatic. And the vixen in this case is Ethel, who's been renamed Esther Rosenstein, who's this Mata Hari, happily a word we no longer use, nymphomaniac, who is just seducing everyone, Russian spies, American attorney generals, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a moral problem for Simon, because on the one hand, he wants to succeed in his new chosen profession. He wants to be an editor at this fancy house. He wants to be accepted into the kind of glittering madman world of 50s publishing, of three martini lunches and social status and so forth. But he knows that it's wrong to publish this book or a book like this. And it's, again, a special problem for him because of his mother's relation with Ethel Rosenberg. So much of the novel is Simon trying to work out his own conscience, really, how he feels about success, how he feels about what he's been asked to do, how he feels about loyalty to his family, to the truth, what may be the truth. And then kind of mixed in with that is the whole question of assimilation, because his family is, I guess his parents, although they're really nothing like my parents, are the generation of my parents, which was much of it was about leaving their big working class Jewish families and becoming part of the assimilated American middle class, upper middle class. And he has to face the questions of what's lost and what's gained. In my opinion, much more is lost than is gained by this assimilation, which he's attempting at great personal cost to himself throughout the novel. And also then there are a number of subplots. As some dissatisfied readers have pointed out, he falls in love with every woman he meets. One of them is the putative author of The Vixen, who's this kind of odd fae creature living in what may or may not be a mental hospital in the Hudson Valley. So, and then there are two other women. So again, the novel just tracks his progress from a confused young postgraduate mess to something much more spoiler stable that he is at the end.
I thought it was so funny the way you had him trying to pursue the job or the graduate degree he wanted next in some like completely random time. I can't even remember what it was because it was
folklore and mythology. It was folklore and mythology. But you know, one of the reasons I had such great sympathy for him was that I was a medieval literature major, also at Harvard. I was a medieval literature major, and it just never occurred to me that this was not the most practical major if I ever wanted to make a living. I mean, once I realized that I didn't want to go into academia, there wasn't a lot I could do with what I'd studied, what I'd learned. So again, but although, I mean, one of the things that made me happy writing the book was that, and I wasn't planning this in advance, but the way in which all the things that seem to me even like kind of sidetracks or details turned out to have some actual bearing on what was happening in the plot. So yes, his studies seemed a little goofy, let's say, but by the end you realize that there was the same dark conspiracy underneath everything else was underneath that as well.
Yes. I can't. It wasn't just the folklore. It was the one that he wanted after. It was the job he wanted after that he couldn't get. Well, anyway, whatever. I'll find. I'm convinced I will find this, but never mind. It's not even important. It's not important, but it was really funny. Anyway, yes. And I also found it so interesting. I mean, this sort of intersection of when you're watching something that is so harrowing and gruesome and emotional, and then, you know, having to put it, the juxtaposition with the shows that their family was watching was one thing, but it's also, you know, a signal to, it's also sort of representative of how we bring in the news of all these horrible things into our life, right? Whether it's a show that interrupts us or if it's, you know, we're running around doing whatever and we open up the newspaper and there's some awful story and you're like, oh, and then you just have to close the newspaper and go running off to, right? Like it's the integration of this horror into regular life. I find that's fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's still, I mean, for better or worse, that still happens the way, you know, some terrible, terrible catastrophe will happen. And then you're not going to leave dinner burning on the stove while you watch it. So some other thing comes in. Yeah, no, a lot of that, I mean, that first scene, it wasn't until I figured out how to write that first scene that I realized I could write the novel. So, and that was because I'd made many, many attempts to write it before. But that first scene, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to happen there was that I thought, well, this is sort of a way of signaling how much it's about families, because although it's kind of, you know, under the surface, that first scene, there are four families going there, the Rosenberg family, Ethel and Julius and their children, who are their sons, the family in the novel, Simon and his parents, and then the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson family and Lucy and Desi, that family. So this just bizarro, comic, tragic interplay of these four families is going on all the way through that scene.
Not to mention, then you bring in the author's family, right? Then it's from your perspective and then the reader's perspective. So it's like this crisscrossed dance of all of the things going on. You know, I read your essay in Lit Hub about the importance of clarity in writing and that writing has to be above all clear. And when I was reading how you wrote this book,
That is absolutely the case. And I was thinking, like, as I was analyzing sort of individual sentences, you know, what did she leave out? Like, what did she choose to keep in? How did she write this sentence? So tell me a little bit about the prose in the writing of this book and how you sort of bring that approach to everything you write.
Well, for one thing, it probably went through 40 or 50 revisions easily. I mean, I knew about 14 at the beginning because I'd saved the drafts and then I stopped counting. And I mean, I have them, you know, if I want to, I can find them on my computer because after a certain point, I start numbering the drafts just so I don't lose anything. So yeah, let's say 50 drafts. And what's the difference? I mean, cutting is a great pleasure. I mean, just, it's like losing weight with no pain. I mean, it's like, you know, the word counter, I love my word counter so much because I've lost 50 words and I haven't noticed. So part of editing is just going through and seeing if you absolutely need everything that's there, if the reader can understand what's there without that. I mean, there's a little danger, which is that once you cut it, it stays in your mind. So it's never, that is, you may have cut something really essential that the reader needs to understand, but it's, you're still thinking it. So you have to go back and fix it. And then clarity, as you said, it's the most important thing. I mean, every line, asking yourself, just on the simplest level, is anyone else but me going to understand what this means? I mean, that's what I tell my students. I mean, I teach at one class at Bard College, and it's a literature class, but my students have to write a weekly 300-word paper. And it's very easy to teach them to write that way because, you know, it's not like we're waiting till the end and they hand me a 15-page disaster. But anyway, I mean, but often I just say to them, what do you mean? You know, because they feel that they have to translate it into this language in which papers are written or whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as soon as they say, this is what I mean, it becomes, then I say, well, why don't you write that? So, and I think that on some level, that process goes on all the way up and down people who have writing experience or no writing experience or veterans or beginners. I mean, that need to say, will someone understand this?
Interesting. And you have written an entire book teaching people how to read as if you were a writer, like what you can get from books in order to write more efficiently, more, how to analyze a text. And I remember before I started this whole podcast thing, I was just a huge reader. You know, I just love to read for fun, but I wasn't taking books apart. And I remember sitting like right here with this one author, Charles Duhigg, I went to college with, and he was like, well, yeah, the first thing I do is, you know, figure it out. I flip through it and I do this and I go through the sections. I do this, then I read it again. Then I unpack it. And I was like, you do what? I'm like, well, I don't do that. So tell me about your approach and why this is important.
Well, I do it in a much more, I do it line by line. And again, that's how I teach. I mean, we just go through it line by line and say, okay, what kind of information are we getting here? What's underneath the subtext? What does the writer, again, not feel necessary to tell us? What are we getting without being told? And just to look at each word, each line, each punctuation mark, really, to see what effect it has on the reader. And also, I think one of the things you're doing when you're writing is that when you're reading as a writer, is that you know how many alternate choices and how many possibilities have been discarded to produce what's on the page. So you can intuit back to, for example, what would be the really bad way of writing this thing that's so good that I'm reading? And it's not that hard to figure out. It's very easy to figure out. So it helps you because it helps you realize why the good choice rather than the bad choice might have been made.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
Interesting. Well, let's go back to Simon in The Vixen and how he approaches his job in publishing and the slush pile. And he's questioning why some things are getting approved and some things are getting rejected and, you know, hiding things sort of under the bed that he wants to read and all of that. There is so much subjectivity in what gets accepted and what doesn't get accepted. What can we take away sort of from the publishing world, particularly people who perhaps are trying to get published or things like that, from the era that he was publishing in? I mean, this kind of reminded me of Joanna Rakoff's book about the letters from J.D. Salinger and how that person at Literary Agency had to like read through all the letters. But there, you know, this sort of time frame, and how do you make sense of the submissions, and who should really be the person deciding what gets published? I don't know. This is sort of a bigger question, but.
Well, in listing the books that he turns down or that have been turned down, I made sure to find books, as I said, that would never get published anywhere at any time. I mean, you just look at the title and you go, I don't think so. So there's that. But also, I think the most important thing to come out of any conversation like this is that the last thing that the writer wants to think about is could this get published, or who's going to get published this, or how is my audience, existent or non-existent, going to greet this? Because it's the quickest way to stop yourself, and not only that, it's the best way to deform what you're writing into some way that has finally nothing to do with you, but has only to do with some imagined readership that you might not have or might not ever have. I mean, believe me, if I was thinking that way at the very beginning, I would not. I mean, if I'd said to myself, who do I think is going to publish and read a comic novel about the Rosenberg execution? That would have been it. I was like, no, absolutely no. I'm not going there. But I knew, but there was something in me that for whatever reason had to do it, just had to write that book. So again, I think that that's more important. The question of what is it you feel that you have to do is much more important than the question is, will anyone ever like this? Maybe yeah. They won't. Maybe they will. You can't tell.
I mean, if you like it, someone's going to like it. Maybe not everybody.
That's what you hope, Zibby. That's what you hope.
At least one other person out there.
Well, I have to say, I feel that I've been incredibly fortunate because I was really worried for all sorts of reasons before this book came out, because of what it is, because it is a comic novel, because of the subject matter. And I was really shocked by the good reviews, to put it just simply, written by people who seemed to get what I was doing, who seemed to understand what I was doing, and who seemed not to be horrified by it. So that was I felt just a blessing and really extraordinary and heartening to me, because you just never know.
Well, I mean, I feel like you did a lot of the things that you're supposed to do to make a great novel. I mean, you have a character we're all kind of rooting for and yet kind of laugh at, and you know, the sort of underdog-ish type guy, and you just like want to see him succeed, and you wrote it well, and it has all this intrigue. And, you know, I knew and didn't know about the Rosenbergs. And I don't know, it's like a little history is thrown in there. So you learn, and I don't know. It transports like a good novel should.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Wait, tell me how did you get started in this industry to begin with? When did you know you were a writer? When did you start writing? And how did it all get to
you? You know, my first novel came out in 1973, I think 74. I was very young. I was very, very young. And actually, my first novel was published by Athenaeum, which was pretty much exactly like the publishing company in the novel. I mean, so much so that I worked out, or I tried to remember back to the layout of the office.
Oh, wow.
And I just tracked my way around the layout of the office. And Pat Kanoff of the Kanoff publishing family was the head of Athenaeum. And he had the office that I gave to Warren in my novel. So, you know, decor, British hunting club, gentleman's hunting club. I mean, I don't remember if he actually had pictures of hunting dogs on the wall, but that's kind of how I remember it. And it started simply, I mean, it started in a way that would, I think, be more rare now, which was that I had taken a few writing classes at college. And then I guess 2 years after I graduated, I gave it to a professor of mine, Monroe Engel, who'd been my writing teacher. And he sent it to his editor at Athenaeum. And he said, I'm going to publish this. I mean, you know, because this was before publishing got so corporate, and this was before you had to bring novels to marketing strategies and explain what the demographic readership was, et cetera, et cetera. And my editor, Harry Ford, who was a wonderful kind of legendary editor, published a lot of poets. He published a lot of poets of that generation. I mean, W.S. Merwin and Mark Strand and Don Justice. So you publish a lot of poets, and sales potential is not the first thing you're thinking of, I think. So he really got it. And then it kind of went along from there. So I was, again, lucky and lucky to have started off at a time, I think, very different from the atmosphere we're in now.
So I recently started my own publishing company. I don't know if you know, it's called Zivi Books, and I launched it in September. And so, you know, this is my sort of office. It is not, there are no hunting prints, you know, this is in
nice looking.
Next to my daughter's room, basically. But I do have like this little team, and it's all remote now with today's world, right? Our slush pile comes in electronically and we review it. And, you know, it's so funny to see what has changed. But I'm so interested in sort of where that started, because a lot of things in publishing today have evolved, not necessarily for the better. It's just the way it's happened, right? Like, how do you go back to taking some of that personal touch of publishing in today's super, super crowded market? So I'm interested in your character, but also your experience, you know, and being in the industry for so long.
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the great things that's happening is that so many of the smaller presses are coming back and succeeding because large corporate culture has never been a great friend of art. I mean, yes, they fund it, et cetera, but not us in particular. So I'm very glad to see that becoming less of a deciding factor about what. So what kind of books do you publish, Libby?
We are publishing fiction and Zivi. Yeah, it's okay. Nobody gets my name right. It's fine. I should just change it to Libby because everybody calls me Libby. We're publishing fiction and memoir, 12 books a year, starting in January 2023. Sort of telling it like it is.
How exciting. That's great.
One book a month. I'm so excited about it. We're getting amazing submissions. We've acquired, I think, 10 books at this point. And yeah, it's fun. It's really fun. But I'm trying to do everything a little bit differently because I want to do it the way I want to do it. I haven't worked in publishing and I want to do it like from an author and reader-centered model. So anyway, I don't want to detract from my conversation about your books, but I'm always looking for information and, you know, ways to do things better and make, I don't know, the books are going to be great. It's just this marketing, you know, it's just so hard to break through anywhere. I mean, nobody's even like watching TV. It's just so hard. I literally said to my child the other day, he's like 14. I was like, okay, if I was going to even take an ad somewhere where like, I want everybody to see it, where would it be? And she's like, what?
Well, you know, I got my son, my younger son is a music producer, and I got him to do a video for the Vixen, which is out there. It's on YouTube and so forth, which was so brilliant. I mean, it's blew me away, and it got put up on Instagram and something. You know, I don't know if it sold any books, but it made me so happy, A, that it was out there, and B, that I could say to my grown kid, hey, made me, you know, it probably took him like 10 minutes or something, but it's fantastic. So I recommend looking for it.
Yes. Okay. So the answer is hire your son to make
hire your kids. For, yes, for sure.
For all of our books. Okay. Good.
That answers that.
Yeah, that answers that. So you mentioned you had been, you'd come back to this book over and over again through the years. Are there other books that have been sort of gnawing away at you, or you have some of that, some of it written and some of it not, or things that, you know, are on your wish list to do?
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple of things, and they're all just so larval, you know, that I can't, I mean, I keep starting the first piece of memoir I've ever, you know, not counting kid, you know, articles about what to feed your kids for dinner. A memoir about something that happened to me in the 70s. And I've been thinking about that. And then there's fictional subjects that just keep floating around, but don't exactly crystallize. So, you know, I mean, I'm interested in those people in the 19th century that took pictures of ghosts, you know, those spirit photographers. So I've been thinking about that as well, but we'll see.
Interesting. And what about your own reading? Like, what do you like to read, and what are some of your favorites, or what are you reading now?
I'm reading Joy Williams's new novel. It's really harrow. It's fantastic. I'm reading, well, it depends what hour of the day you ask me. I mean, in the middle of the night, I like to read just really, you know, like P.D. James, because I can read mystery thrillers and forget who did it. So I'm always coming to them fresh. So, you know, Insomniac reading, but also because I'm teaching, and it's a strange course. It's called Sympathy for the Devil. And it's about how writers create sympathy for apparently unsympathetic characters. So this week we're doing High Wind in Jamaica by Richard Hughes. And the week before last, we did this extraordinary book called Into That Darkness by Gita Sereny. It's nonfiction. It's a book-length interview with the commandant of Treblinka, which is, you know, and I said, okay, you know, let's just see if there's anyone who's beyond sympathy. Let's just see, let's just push it as far as we can to see. So naturally he came to mind. So it was rough. And I felt sort of badly about putting my students through that, but whatever.
There is all this debate about how you feel about a book with an unlikable
character. Oh, you know, it's maddening. Maddening. I was reading, actually, there's a New York Review Books just published an Elizabeth Taylor novel, Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, I think. And it starts with, there's a great introduction by Michael Hoffman. And he says that the word relatable means that people are being narcissistic even when they're reading. And it reminds him, I can't remember what the source, but some young woman saying, I don't really like reading books because I'm not in them. And I think that there's some of that going on with relatability, a word I've asked my students not to use, because I keep saying to them, it's not about you. That's the point. It's not about you. You know about you. You don't have to see yourself. Hmm. You can see something about yourself that you never knew was there or that you recognize. But, you know, I'm not Anna Karenina, but there are things about everyone I know and people in general that I see whenever I reread that novel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so many, when you think about how many different parts of yourself there are, of course, you're going to find little its and bits and pieces of them everywhere. Although I did just for Hanukkah give my kids books that say like their names on the cover. You know, you can like personalize books now from sites like Wonderbly and Pen Wizard or whatever. And so it could be like, you know, so-and-so, you know, anyway, instead of saying like a random character, I'm trying not to say my kids' names because I like to keep it private. Let's pretend their name is Jane. Like Jane goes to the market or whatever. And then like this Jane's bedtime story. So then they go in and you can make the character kind of look like you. Anyway, I guess I'm raising narcissists is basically my point here.
Well, that's different though. I mean, I think anything you can do to get kids to read is fair and square. I mean, you know, I'm fine with a book with arms that give kids a big hug that come out of it. And, you know, because the fact that we're competing with their screens, it really feels very, very hard. So anything that does that, and I keep getting reports from friends who tell me how their children are buried in books and they can't get their children's head out of it. This is not my experience. Neither of my sons were that big a reader. And my grandchildren It's hard. There's the water, the jury's still out, but except maybe for one, they don't seem to be passionate readers. It was funny. One of my 14-year-old granddaughter took a book home from school and she had to read for her AP book. And I said, "Oh, that book, it's horrible." And she said, "There's a blurb from you on the back cover, Grandma." So then I had to explain that I'd reviewed the book and they picked the one really nice thing I'd said out of the review and put it on the cover, and I had no control over that. And so, but I felt like some element of credibility had been.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
That is so funny. By the way, the section you wrote about the Jell-O box was so funny. Can I just read like that paragraph?
Please, it's my favorite part of the book.
Oh my God, it's so funny. You said, "The newscaster tells us yet again how the state's case hinged on a torn box of Jell-O that served as a signal between the spies. The communist agent, Harry Gold, had half the box, Ethel's brother, the other half. Gold's handlers instructed him to say, 'This comes from Julius. The jagged fragments of the Jell-O box fit like jigsaw puzzle pieces.' She should have stayed kosher," Mom says. "Observant Jews don't eat Jell-O. Cloven hoof, smooth hoof, the wrong hoof, I forget what. Some rabbi ruled that Jell-O was kosher," says Dad. "Probably the Jell-O people found a rabbi they could pay off. Was Ethel kosher, I ask? Who cares? There was no torn Jell-O box," my father says, "except in someone's head."
Yeah, there was no torn Jell-O box.
Then you kept writing about it, and you said, "The strawberry Jell-O is in Roy Cohn's head. My mother curses in Yiddish." I say, "Did they specify strawberry? Is this a joke to you, Simon?" Anyway.
Yeah, Roy Cohn's head. Roy Cohn is just the evil Zelig that just keeps reappearing in this story. You know, he was the prosecutor in the Rosenberg case, and then Donald Trump's mentor and McCarthy's boy. So he was around.
Wasn't there just a documentary or something about him? I feel like there was.
No, well, actually, the woman who made it, there were two documentaries about him that came out within the first 3 months. And one of the women who made what seems to me the better one is the granddaughter of the Rosenbergs, Ivy Meeropol. So she made that documentary, and then she made another one called, what's it called? Witness to an Execution? Heir to an Execution? I can't remember, but it's wonderful. And I watched it a million times writing the book. It's a documentary about her family and the case and so on and so on.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thanks, Brooklyn. Great to meet you.
Thank you, Zibi.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibi Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibiOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week.
Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.